from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Happy Wednesday to you. We're halfway through the week before holiday madness begins. We're almost there. All right, so there's a lot of news coming out of L.A. this morning, including the latest with the teacher strike. The L.A. Unified School District has told the teachers union in no uncertain terms that it should take its offer of a 6% raise. We'll find out if teachers agree or if they vote to strike later this morning. Stay tuned right here to KPCC. But first, to that mysterious tunnel that Elon Musk has dug under the city of Hawthorne. He first proposed the idea on Twitter 2 years ago. Now, his grand idea, expressed in one tweet, is to beat LA street traffic by burrowing and traveling underneath it. Last night, it all became real as Musk's Boring Company opened its first completed tunnel running underground for a little bit more than a mile between Crenshaw Boulevard and Prairie Avenue. Now, here's Musk addressing the crowd.
Why tunnels? Sometimes people say, what about like flying cars and all these other things? What about mass transit? I want to be clear, we're not opposed to mass transit. We think mass transit is fine. Let's try every solution possible.
All right, well, one lucky duck KPCC staffer got to test out this subterranean solution, and she's here to tell us all about it. Who else would it be but Sue Carpenter? Of course,
hey. You
go out there.
I am the lucky duck.
Yeah, you are. Now, okay, now, we've been talking about this for a while, but remind folks about how this whole operation works.
Well, right now, it is just one tunnel and some modified Tesla Model X SUVs because this is just a proof of concept. But eventually, the goal is to have an entire underground network of tunnels that would operate like a freeway system. So there would be a bunch of high-speed tunnels with multiple on- and off-ramps that are accessed with car elevators. Those tunnels could be stacked to maximize volume. And the cars that will be in those tunnels would be small electric vehicles that can go directly from point A to point B. No stops. Musk said those cars could either be privately owned or publicly operated, but they need to be small because travelers aren't typically going to the same place. And Musk has a name for the system. He calls it the Loop.
The Loop. All right. Now, the Model X you rode in was modified. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was pretty trippy. So it had an extra set of wheels on the front that are horizontally oriented. So the regular set of wheels was driving on the ground, and then the second set of wheels that were only in the front, those were actually riding the walls.
I can picture that.
And that's to sort of stop it from ping-ponging down the tunnel just to smooth out the ride, but the ride was still sort of bumpy, but that had everything to do with the texture of the walls.
That sounds pretty cool. All right. Now, it does.
It is.
Being honest. Now, walk me through the process. How did you even get in the tunnel?
Well, I took the street. There are two entrances. One is in a SpaceX parking lot, and Elon Musk said that was so that he could see it from his office window. The other one is about a mile away in a residential...
The wizard overlooking Oz, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. So the other one was in this residential neighborhood, which is where I entered. That entrance is at the end of a nondescript alley next to a custom wheel shop where there was a giant metal plate that the Model X driver wheeled onto. The center of that plate then acted like an elevator. It dropped us down 30 feet to the mouth of the tunnel. I was one of four passengers being driven. And we idled at the tunnel entrance for a few seconds, just looking down this big white tube with a ring of red lights at its entrance. And then the light turned green, the driver floored it, and we were speeding through the tunnel.
That sounds like Disneyland. Did it have a Disneyland feel?
It was sort of like Space Mountain. Yeah, it did.
That's what it sounds like. Okay, how fast were you going?
Well, I was peeking at the speedometer because I was sitting right behind the driver, and the highest it went was 43 miles per hour, which is not all that fast because Musk says traffic is going to be able to reach speeds of 150 miles per hour. I can't even imagine zipping through that thing at that speed.
I was expecting light speed, but 43.
Eventually,
43
maybe,
is okay.
Yeah.
So what is what does a tunnel look like?
Well, it is plain white. It has a flat bottom. It's just 12 feet in diameter, so it can only fit cars. This demonstration tunnel is just over a mile long. And what was interesting about this trip is that the driver was playing the car radio the entire time. And that's because the tunnel has Wi-Fi and it also has cell phone service.
Did you feel weird being that far underground?
No, I didn't, because I don't know. You don't ride the subway, do you?
Not much. But whenever I do, I kind of feel like, oh, I know I'm underground. I kind of get this uneasy feeling.
Yeah.
The ground shifts here in LA. I don't know if you know that, Sue Carpenter. The ground moves here.
But we've had this conversation before. It's actually a safe place to be.
So, yeah, it is. That's right. Now, okay, so was the ride all that?
Was the ride all that? Yes and no. Yes, because even last week I was told we might not only be able to look inside the tunnel. But this is very typical of Musk. It's like under promise, over deliver, and then you're like super wowed. But it was super cool to personally experience this after all the hype. And I have to say, though, that it's a lot of political will if it's going to be pulled off to the extent it needs to. A lot of money, a lot of time to build this network of tunnels that's really robust enough to really help with traffic at the street level. But I have to say that it's a super impressive start with a lot of promise if, and this is a very big if, the building time and the construction costs are both radically reduced.
Yeah, you would think that would have to happen. Do you think, though, Sue, that
yes.
Hawthorne's tunnel will ever open to the public?
Well, that is anyone's guess. Musk said it depends on regulatory approval, and he didn't say when that might be. The first commercially operated loop system will probably be in Chicago, and that would actually be cool because it's supposed to be 18 miles.
Oh, wow. All right. Yeah. Now, how much would a ride cost?
Musk is saying it's going to be about $1 per person, but he also said it's a little bit too early to say for sure.
So, okay. So it sounds like just the ride itself that you went on was a bit of a trip. The scene. What was the scene around the event?
It is always a madhouse when Elon Musk has an event. You know, it's a media event, but it's also a party. It took place at the tunnel's entrance. So there was a bunch of, like, huge boring machines. There were stacks of concrete slabs. And those were right next to a full bar, a Pink's hot dog stand, a s'mores station. And, of course, Musk started the event by driving through the tunnel. And this was, like, broadcast on a screen. And then he spoke to the crowd from the tunnel space.
A party at a tunnel. That sounds like a rave that I went to in 1992. But
yeah.
That was when I was a
Didn't
lot younger.
We all?
No, it's, we all did, right? Now, okay, so I understand the medieval watchtower. There was one there. What was that all about?
That is just crazy. So there was this huge, very skinny medieval tower. It was all about bricks. So the tower was made from boring company bricks that are made from dirt that are pulled out during construction of the tunnel. There were actually, because Musk is supposedly a Monty Python fan, they had actually hired this cluster of the knights from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I actually heard them clomping behind me coming into the event. So these bricks, they're seismically graded so they can actually be used in construction, and this medieval tower was proof. The bricks aren't available yet, but eventually they're going to sell for 10 cents a piece, and they're going to be sold at a new brick store that was actually right at the entrance of the tunnel that I went into. It's kooky.
All right, final word, Sue, because I think with Elon Musk, the one thing I think we can all agree on is that he is a dreamer. So the tunnel, yay or nay? Thumbs up, thumbs down.
I like the big idea. I think it has a lot of potential. I also think it's going to take just a ton of work to make this actually happen. But keep in mind that Musk launched an electric car company from scratch. He's building rockets and sending them to the International Space Station. So Musk has pulled off big things in the past, so we'll see if this actually works out.
All right, KPCC Sue Carpenter. She's one of the few who got to take a ride in the new Boring Company demonstration tunnel in Hawthorne last night. Sue, get some rest. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right, another local news. LA Unified school teachers are on the brink of a strike that would all but paralyze the nation's second largest school district. We're waiting on a big announcement from the teachers union, expected around 10 o'clock this morning. United Teachers LA has been locked in a contract dispute with the district for almost 2 years now. Negotiations have fallen short so far, and the parents of more than 480,000 kids are now watching for the teachers' next move. Yesterday, an outside negotiator offered formal recommendations for resolving the dispute, and LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner told the union to take the 6% raise it was offered back in October. KPCC's Kyle Stokes has been following the story and joins us now. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Abe.
All right. For starters, why exactly do these recommendations matter?
Well, for starters, the fact-finding report, this whole process of getting this outside expert to weigh in, this is the last step that UTLA has to go through before it can legally strike. And so now that this report is out, there really is no hurdle left between them and a possible strike. But the other reason that these recommendations matter is that they can sometimes unstick a stuck negotiation. You can, the fact finder came in here, as they often do, and they sort of say, well, one side's right about this, the other side is right about this. As you just mentioned, the fact finder weighed in and said, for instance, that the district's salary offer of 6% is a 6% raise for teachers union members. That's a good offer. You should go with that. And the thinking behind this fact finding process is, well, if you make one big statement like that, one concession might be able to cascade into an agreement. So that's why they can matter, because sometimes it's the roadmap for the agreement. On the other hand, they're just suggestions. either side could just rip them up, ignore them, do nothing with them. They are not legally binding. So that's the danger here, too.
So how are these recommendations going over?
Well, they're so far, I think both sides are still kind of squabbling over what is being put forward here. I think that the district found a lot to like in the fact finder's report. They obviously, as we just have said, the fact finder supported the district salary agreement. The fact finder also sort of said both sides had some good points to make about class sizes. The union for a long time has wanted class sizes, this provision in the contract that allows the district to gives them a lot of flexibility to raise class sizes whenever essentially LAUSD wants. The union has wanted that provision gone from the contract. They've wanted to go back to the table on class sizes. The district themselves has offered their own ideas on class size. The fact finder said both sides have a bit of a point here. They should go back to the table and work it out. I think both sides sort of claimed victory there. But I think there's also a lot of frustration because buried within that class size debate, for instance, you talk to Austin Buettner and he says, we've come to the table with ideas, but we haven't found a willing negotiating partner in UTLA. And so that's led to comments like what he said yesterday to reporters after a press conference.
Don't tell me that you're acting in the interest of students. Don't tell me that a crisis helps families living in poverty. It does not. So my frustration, if that's what you're hearing in my voice, is we'd like to solve this.
But I think the union was also pretty frustrated because for a couple of reasons. One, they feel like the district hasn't been coming forward and engaging in good faith with a lot of union proposals, including some outside of this arena of salaries and class sizes. In addition to that, they accused Buettner of mischaracterizing where they stand on salaries. Buettner came out at the press conference yesterday, said that the teachers' union had agreed to a salary increase of 6%. What actually happened was a little bit less than that. The union's appointee to the fact-finding process had said that, yeah, it's not a bad recommendation to, go with the district's contract offer of 6%. So it's a very fine difference there, but the accusation of lying sort of is an indication that the fact-finding report may not be all that's needed to get these two sides to an agreement.
I don't know, Kyle, from the outside looking in, it's been 2 years. It still feels like it's a mess. As we mentioned a moment ago, we're kind of waiting on a big announcement from the union, and it's really anybody's guess what they're going to say. But given all this back and forth, and especially considering the last 24 hours, what's your expectation?
I think they are going to announce that they're going to put a lump of coal in Austin Buettner's stocking or something like that. I don't know what's going to happen, but I just don't think it can be anything good if what you are hoping for is a resolution to this rather than an escalation.
All right, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. You can follow more of his reporting at our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. And he's also on Twitter at KYStokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You bet.
And stay tuned to KPCC for developments about the teachers' strike if it happens. We'll update you with the very latest news as we have it. And if you're an LAUSD parent, we want to hear from you. What's your take on all this? Do you support the teachers' right to strike? How will it affect your family if there is a strike? You can go to Take Two's Facebook page and let us know. All right, last week we told you how Los Angeles is home to many innovations that have changed the world, things like supermarkets, skateboarding, and the internet. Well, along those lines, LA is also the center of a universe that dictates a lot of what people wear, eat, buy, and also how people think. And the rulers of this universe, well, some might be shocked at how young some of them are. Find out who they are when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Thousands of migrants have been gathering in Tijuana, hoping for asylum in the United States. Some will be deported. Others choose to go home. Some will wait in detention centers for hearings. And some will be allowed to live in California while their cases wind through the system. But making a life here is expensive. Even so, California asylum seekers here have certain advantages. As part of our statewide California Dream collaboration, KPCC's David Wagner introduces us to one family that just arrived.
Rosa left El Salvador, she says, to get her family away from gang violence. She had a picture in her head of Los Angeles.
Lujosa, muy bonita.
Luxurious, beautiful. Some areas are like that, she says, but her corner of LA feels familiar.
A veces siento aquello como que yo estuviera en la capital del Salvador.
She sometimes feels like she's in the capital of El Salvador. We're only using Rosa's first name because her asylum case is ongoing. She was surprised by how expensive housing is here. For the first month, she and her two kids lived in cramped quarters with another family.
Donde ellos viven es bien pequeño.
She says the place was very small. They couldn't even access the bathroom at night. Since then, she's found a studio apartment near downtown LA. But supporting her family will be a struggle. Asylum seekers can't get a work permit until at least 6 months into their case. Many work under the table to get by. Still, Rosa says California has what she needs, safety, and the chance of a better life for her kids.
Aquí hay una oportunidad. Aquí
she says there's opportunity here, and lawyers willing to help. Asylum advocates say California's legal community has really stepped up in recent years. The data shows those lawyers make a huge difference.
Finding a lawyer, we find throughout, is powerfully associated with positive outcomes in these cases.
UCLA law professor Ingrid Igley did a study that found families released from detention only won asylum 7% of the time when they didn't have a lawyer. Those who had a lawyer increased their odds of winning to 49%. That data only goes up to 2016. Lawyers say the odds are shrinking since President Trump took office. Even so, legal aid is still crucial for asylum seekers.
They're more likely to be able to gather evidence, to work collaboratively with their lawyer, and to otherwise prepare and find witnesses who can testify in their case.
Rosa's pro bono asylum lawyer, Patricia Ortiz, at the Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project, says just being in larger California cities can give asylum seekers an edge.
In LA, perhaps more so than in other regions, I think the city and the county have made efforts to assist immigrants and refugees as best they can.
But for clients outside larger California cities,
it's next to impossible for them to get any kind of resources, and it's a very big struggle that we're always dealing with.
But staying in California can be hard. Jenna Gilbert at Human Rights First says it's heartbreaking to get calls from clients who say they're leaving months into their case because they just can't afford to stay. She tells them they're not just losing their lawyer. They're leaving behind California's more asylum-friendly Ninth Circuit.
If you move to a small town in Texas, housing is going to be much cheaper, but you probably won't have the legal resources, and you also will be in a circuit that is much less favorable to asylum seekers.
Rosa knows the judge in her case could decide to send her back to El Salvador, but she says she'd do well here if she's allowed to stay.
Soy una persona trabajadora, honrada y honesta.
She says she's hardworking, honorable, and honest, and just wants opportunity for her family, opportunity she wouldn't have in their home country. In Los Angeles, I'm David Wagner.
And tomorrow, we'll hear from a family that's been in LA for 2 years and is still waiting for a decision. All right, now to something affecting American culture in a big way, influencers. It's a phenomenon that isn't going away anytime soon, even if a lot of people aren't sure exactly what an influencer is or does. Now, typically, an influencer has a following of thousands or even millions on social media platforms such as Instagram and YouTube, and advertisers pay them big bucks to endorse clothes, makeup, or other merchandise. Now, if you're wondering where the center of the influencer universe is located, you're sitting, standing, and driving in it. It's right here in Los Angeles. Yeah, people come here from far and wide to gain social media fame. Documentary filmmaker Gina Pollack knows a thing or two about this. She produced KCET's latest episode of SoCal Connected, which takes a deep dive into the influencer world. Gina, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You dove into the world and you emerged unscathed.
Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. Now, okay, so for people who aren't familiar with the term, what qualifies someone as an influencer?
So I would say that someone who
influences products, influences what people buy is really what I would consider an influencer. So the way that I qualify it is someone who does sponsored posts. So that could be wearing a t-shirt or wearing a makeup product that someone sent them in order to have someone else buy it. It's kind of also like a popularity contest in a way. So it could be, you know, the kind of person that might be popular in high school. It could be someone who's just attractive, someone who's funny, someone who's charismatic. But now it's on this huge scale so that, you know, instead of just the people in high school knowing who you are, it's everyone who has a smartphone.
I've seen little kids on YouTube reviewing toys.
Yes.
Those are influencers, technically,
yes.
Right?
So actually one of the biggest YouTube stars is called Ryan's Toys. It's this kid that just opens presents on YouTube, and he is the most popular kid on YouTube right now. He's probably like 9 years old.
So how much can an influencer make salary-wise or money-wise? I guess it's not a salary, but money-wise. Give us a range.
So I've heard a lot of different things about this. One stat I've heard is for every 10,000 followers you have, you can make about $100 per post. So say you have 60,000 followers, that's $600 per post. But it really varies. There's not really a standard that's set. And so a lot of people have called this the Wild Wild West of marketing. People can charge anywhere from $200 a post to $200,000 a post. And someone like Kylie Jenner can make $1 million a post.
Wow.
So it's very lucrative if you're doing it correctly.
Now, obviously, we're in an industry town here, but you can take an Instagram photo or film a YouTube video absolutely anywhere you want. LA, though, Gina, what makes LA such a hub for this kind of media?
I think that it definitely has something to do with the Hollywood industry being here. I think that LA has always been a place where people come to be seen and get noticed. But I think that one of the reasons why people come here is because of the Paul brothers. This is Jake and Logan Paul. They came here a long time ago, about 10 years ago, and became Vine stars. They came from the Midwest, and they started this group called Team 10. And they all moved to this building called 1600 Vine on Hollywood and Vine, where they would all make videos together and YouTube sketches. And they just blew up. They're still some of the biggest influencers out there, and they're very controversial. Logan Paul, if you might remember, is the one who made a video inside of a suicide forest in Japan.
I do remember that, yeah.
So they kind of set the standard for people from other places in the U.S. saying, listen, if I really want to make it as an influencer, I have to come to L.A. This is the place to be. This is where all the parties are, all the events, and this is where I can go to places like the Pink Wall on Melrose, yeah, and take a photo and tag it. There's this whole influencer tourism industry that's kind of begun here.
LA's like the perfect backdrop for the influencer world, right?
It is. There's very good lighting here.
Yeah, there is all the time, it seems.
Golden
like.
Hour.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's places like this Pink Wall. There's murals all over Melrose. So people will actually come here and do this kind of tour of all these murals. And they'll sometimes end up at this place called the Carrera Cafe, which I went to, where you can get your selfie printed on your coffee. And you can also get Kim Kardashian's face. You can get different hashtags printed there. And then you can take a selfie with your latte, and that will get you even more followers. So it's this whole culture of posting and getting reposted.
We're talking to documentary filmmaker Gina Pollack. She produced KCET's latest episode of SoCal Connected. Takes a deep dive into the influencer world. Now, some of these influencers are really, really young. 14-year-old Robert Safar. And they might not even understand the ripple effects of being Instagram famous. But here's a clip from the SoCal Connected episode you produced. This is Safar talking about the kinds of messages he gets from followers.
It's kind of scary. I don't know. I get a lot of DMs asking for help. Like, some of them are, like, depressed or some, like, have anxiety and they don't know how to deal with it. So they try to ask me for help, and I try to do as best I can, but I'm only 14, so I don't know about the real world that much.
So, Gina, listening to that, can you elaborate on what you found to be the challenges of young influencers and what they encounter?
Well, someone
that's
like...
some heavy stuff right there.
Yeah, so Robert is actually just 14, like he said. He posted a picture of himself with Bill Nye the Science Guy in a gym, and for some reason just went viral overnight. He now has about 30,000 followers. His parents have no idea what he's doing. His dad is an immigrant from Syria, and it's just like, I don't even know what Instagram is. I don't understand. And he's just, he's a freshman in high school. And a lot of his followers are, you know, real adults in their 30s. And they're messaging him asking for advice and for help. And
messaging a kid.
Adults. And some of them don't realize maybe how young he is. He posts a lot about sad boys music, which is a genre is generally about being depressed. A lot of people with face tattoos. So I think he attracts a certain audience of people who might feel depressed, and they're really reaching out for him. And I think for a lot of these young kids, they don't really know what they're getting themselves into. They don't have like a PR team helping them craft their statements. You know, they often get a lot of negative comments and they don't know how to deal with it. Robert has been called a lot of racial slurs for being Arab. Oh, man. He's been called words for gay that I don't want to say on the air. And he's gotten a lot of really mean comments from people, and he's such a young kid that I think he says that he brushes it aside and that he doesn't want to let it affect him. But I think deep down, if you're only, you know, 14 getting comments like that, it could be really damaging.
Let me squeeze in one more clip from Under the Influence. This is Christina Zilber. She helps run her 16-year-old daughter's Instagram account, which has more than 15,000 followers. Here, Christina talks about making her daughter's account public.
It was a big decision to let her go public. I know a lot of kids her age are still private, just because you don't know where that line is crossed between, you know, strangers kind of peering into your life and finding out where you live and all of that. So it makes me a little bit nervous, but I think she's mature enough and handles herself well.
Stage parents have had a bad history here in Hollywood, but is this the same thing, sort of?
I think it's really similar, except that there's not really a precedent for it. So we don't really know how being a social media influencer is going to affect a teenager in 10 years, because people who are, you know, the founders of this industry are now like 28 years old. It's so new. So I think parents don't always know how to do this the right way. There's not really a roadmap for doing it. And a lot of them are doing the best they can, but a lot of it is really out of their control. Their kids are answering DMs on Instagram. They're posting stories all the time, and they can't monitor everything that they're doing, even though some of their kids are, you know, as young as 9 years old being fashion influencers, for example.
Gina Pollack is a documentary filmmaker, produced KCET's latest episode of SoCal Connected, Under the Influence. Gina, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Really difficult to open a restaurant in LA, even harder to keep one open. Many times, keeping the quality up to your standards is too much of an uphill struggle, so you cut corners. One place in Boyle Heights did that. It suffered, and a local family saved it. Find out all about it when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. George's Burgers in Boyle Heights has been serving customers since the 60s. It was once considered a staple of the neighborhood, but once the owner stepped away, quality began to decline. The menu ballooned to more than 60 items. Fresh meat patties were replaced with frozen ones. The signature Thousand Island sauce, once made from scratch, was replaced by vats of Smart & Final's pre-made brand, and the customers stopped coming. But what you may not know is that the beloved Boyle Heights burger joint got a homegrown revamp this fall. I went to go check it out with LAist food editor Alina Shatkin. And while we waited for our food, she told me about the local business owners that swooped in to save George's.
Their names are Armando De La Torre and his son Armando Jr. And they run Guisados, which is a little local
taco chain.
Everyone
knows that place, yeah.
Yeah, they opened their first Guisados a few years ago, just a block or two away. And, you know, the family is well known in the neighborhood because they run a real estate business and have done so for many, many years. They grew up coming here, and they noticed it very personally when the food went downhill. So they decided, well, we know real estate, we know food, let's do something about it. And they bought the place.
Bought the place and tightened things up.
Yeah, they in the fall, they very quietly shut the place down for a few days to do some remodeling. They didn't announce that they had bought it. They just spiffed things up. They painted, they fixed the sign, and then they brought in new fresh ingredients. They sourced them all, fresh ground beef, cheese from their preferred supplier, things like that. Yeah. And they reopened kind of quietly, and then they had trimmed the menu way down, and word got out, oh, George's is back.
You mentioned some things that are on the menu. Pastrami, right?
Yeah. Okay, so pastrami sandwiches, they have some great ones here. Burgers, their great breakfast sandwich, breakfast burrito, shakes, and their chili cheese fries, which, oh my goodness, look. Oh, look, it is being delivered to us.
All over here. Oh my goodness. Wow.
There we go. So we have chili cheese fries. This is a breakfast burrito with chorizo. Our George's Burger with longhorn cheese. My name's Robert McCord. I'm a partner here at George's Burger Stand.
I'm Armando Della Torre, Jr., the other half of the George's Burger Stand. Happy to have you guys.
Yeah, so...
they brought us a plate of food. I don't know how they managed to come over here with their angel wings, because this smells amazing. This is some pretty amazing stuff in front of us.
Yeah, tell me what you guys do here with the breakfast burrito.
Yeah, well, the breakfast burrito is really simple. Breakfast potatoes that we make every day. This one has chorizo and eggs. We make our salsa in-house, and then just a little bit of cheese, pico de gallo, and that's pretty much it. But we offer it in either bacon, sausage, chorizo, or you can do like a vegetarian and just get papas. Or you can order all of it. We don't really care as long as you pay for it.
What about this Thousand Island dressing?
The Thousand Island we make in-house. George's has kind of always been known to make their own Thousand Island, and over the past few years they haven't. So when we first started here, we were like, let's make our own Thousand Island. And I looked at Robert. I was like, do you know how to make Thousand Island? He's like, nope. And neither have I. So we just practiced and practiced and practiced, worked out a couple kinks, and I think we really got it down. This is one of my favorite Thousand Islands.
What is the secret to a good Thousand Island? I've never known.
It has a lot to do with, with anything. It has a lot to do with, like, your ratios of things. There's not too much relish. There's not too much ketchup. We just try to balance it. And that was our biggest trouble at the beginning, was like trying to balance it. At first it was too ketchup-y, then it was too acidic. And so it was just a combination of a lot of different flavors, and we had to balance it out.
Armando, Alina was telling us earlier how the menu ballooned here. It just got crazy. Too many things that were being offered.
Right.
The quality suffered. How did you guys decide what to keep and what to throw out?
Two ways. One of, what's a classic burger stand going to offer? Second of all, we also wanted to stay within our own wheelhouse. So we didn't want to offer too many things that we didn't know how to do. So we started really basic. Like I said, we didn't know how to make Thousand Island. So let's figure it out. Okay, now that's on the menu. We don't really know how to make a good chili. Let's figure it out. All right, now that's on the menu. And we just kind of kept adding. Even right now, we're talking about adding a patty melt to it. I told my mom, I named it after her. My mom, we call her Patty. So
wait a second, you're thinking about adding something to the menu. Isn't that what got George's in trouble to begin with?
Right, except the fact that we're still trying to stay classic. A patty melt is very classic. You know what I mean? Like I said before, we're not trying to get gimmicky. We just want to be very simple and simple in our approach.
You know, Armando, considering how neighborhoods in L.A. change all the time, Boyle Heights has also in some ways changed along with the times. How do you hope this business here, George's, right in the middle of Boyle Heights, changes along with the neighborhood?
I think it's just about challenging the neighborhood to try to eat a little more consciously. You know, I'm not saying this food's healthy, but it's fresh.
All right. I think you have to try the burger.
Yeah, the burger.
I'm going to try a little bit of this breakfast burrito here.
We got you a chorizo breakfast burrito, and it's a very, if you notice when you bite into it, it's a very clean chorizo. A lot of places when you go get chorizo, it's very greasy. So it's like a nice hearty chorizo that's from Papa Cantinella's.
Yeah. Salsa verde on it because, you know.
This is a very balanced burger.
Thank you.
Totally balanced burger. Wow.
It's part of your healthy, balanced breakfast.
I know it is, right? I could live on this stuff. Wow, this is really great. So let me ask you this, Armando. Say a year from now, we come back and visit George's here in Boyle Heights. Where do you hope George's is in terms of how it fits into this neighborhood and also just as a business here in Boyle Heights?
I really hope it does exactly what it's doing right now in the sense that it's bringing people from different areas into Boyle Heights. So many of our friends and support, especially people that love Guisados, have been like, oh, Guisados, you know, and George's. So they've been coming by based off of that. And I think that's the beauty of any business, especially in Boyle Heights, is bringing people from out of Boyle Heights into it. People that want to come and see this area of LA that's so old and so historic. And we just want consistency. And one thing I do hope is when you come back that it's either just as good or better.
Armando and Robert, thank you very much for first bringing the food out to us and for having us out here. And maybe we will come back in a year and see
Absolutely.
Where things are at.
We look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Elena, so we just ate a lot of really, really good food.
Yes, we did.
I feel really, really great right now, so I got my little food high going. But, okay, so George's here in Boyle Heights. It's not the only place of its kind that's been getting a revamp in L.A.
Not at all. For example, another well-known bagel shop, Brooklyn Bagel, which had been closed for several years after there had been a fire and, like, part of the building had collapsed, and they basically had to close up the whole store, just reopened in the last month or two. So people, I think, are very excited to have Brooklyn Bagel back, and that's over on Beverly, kind of right near Alvarado. And Clifton's Cafeteria is undergoing a bit of a change. So, you know, Clifton's has been around since 1934, 1935. And several years ago, the menu had kind of gotten out of control. The quality had gotten way down. I mean, it was always a cafeteria. It was never fancy food, but it had gone down even from there. And it was bought by a new owner, and then it had a fire. He shut it down. His name is Andrew Myron. And he spent, about 4.5 years and a lot of money revamping it. Restored it to its former glory. And if you've ever been inside Clifton's, you know, the giant redwood tree, the animatronic animals, the
waterfall.
Paradise
of weirdness. Yeah.
Yes.
But it's
fun. A
complete
woodsy wonderland weirdness festival. And unfortunately, it wasn't doing that well. So they were just kind of recently pretty much shut it down. And when I talked to him, about a week ago or so, he told me that they are revamping it, so it's not going to be really a cafeteria like it was anymore, and it's going to be something closer to a food hall. My understanding is that they're going to keep all the old decor, but it's going to be something more like Eataly, where you have different stations, and you go, and you get a bunch of, you know, pre-made or pre-packaged food, and you can take it away with you, or you can eat it there.
You've been writing about the food scene in L.A. for a long time. What do you think it says about the city that... See, a lot of places, typically, when something fails, for whatever reason, there's a problem, it gets completely torn away, washed away from the neighborhood, and something brand new replaces it. But as we've seen with George's, you mentioned Clifton's, and you mentioned the bagel place, Brooklyn Bagel, that they're revamping instead of replacing.
It's true. L.A. has a terrible history of tearing down some of its most amazing buildings and landmarks. But we also have a really strong preservationist streak. People care about the businesses in their community, especially if they make really amazing bagels like Brooklyn Bagel, or especially if they just have this really amazing one-of-a-kind, you know, venue like Clifton's. Like, there's nowhere else in the world quite like that.
Yeah.
So I think people really care, and it shows that, you know, sometimes people really are willing to work hard and preserve it. But, you know, there's also a challenge to that, which is making it relevant and enticing to people in the year 2018, because, you know, what worked for people in the midst of the Great Depression in the 1930s is not necessarily going to be a big draw in the 21st century.
Elena, thanks for letting us tag along here at George's. It was a really, really great meal.
You're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I really had to twist your arm to get you out here.
And you can check out more about the George's revamp at LAist.com. All right, 'tis the season for, that's right, Christmas displays on front yards all over Southern California. There's one in Orange County, though, that has gone all Emeril Lagasse and kicked it up a notch. It takes more than a month to make. We'll bring you right to it in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Los Angeles has a lot of vacant lots, more than 20,000, and now the city has approved a pilot program to try to put some of them to good use. The project is called Adopt a Lot, and it'll let communities decide how they'd like to transform vacant city-owned lots in their areas. Now, for more on how the system will work, we turn now to Naria Kiani. She's Senior Planning Coordinator at Konkuni Design Initiative, one of the groups in something called the Free Los Angeles Collective. Naria, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, when you develop these lots, it'll be the communities deciding what they become. How does that process work?
We will be doing outreach to communities living around these lots and looking for folks to actually adopt them. And then we'll go through technical assistance workshops with the groups that adopt them. And there will be some limitations on those uses, so they can't actually build anything or... significantly alter the sites, but there'll be a range of opportunities from community gardens to meeting spaces to park spaces. And so they'll get to kind of tweak what they'd like to use them for.
That technical assistance we mentioned, what does that look like? The help you'll be giving them?
So there's a two-step application process. So the first step is an interest form, and the next step is the license agreement. And in that license agreement, it asks for a site plan, a maintenance plan, programming plan, what sort of site furnishing. So we'll take folks step by step and work with them to fill that out and develop their concept for the site.
Now, for this pilot program, you've selected a number of lots. How did you pick the ones you did? How do you pick those locations?
Yeah, so the General Services Department, we're working with them on this program. So they have a portfolio of surplus vacant lots and gave us that list. And so we went through each one of those. There's hundreds of lots on the list and removed lots that didn't meet our criteria. So removed lots that were on hillsides or had structures or were larger than 2 acres. So after taking away all those lots and then doing site visits, we only had about 6 lots left that were feasible.
Now, do you try and focus on any particular neighborhoods, maybe a neighborhood that would really, really benefit from having one of these things?
Yes, absolutely. That's a sort of core goal of this program, is to bring new public spaces to the neighborhoods that don't have enough of those, particularly in low-income communities.
So how is the Adopt-A-Lot program going to be funded?
Yeah, so right now we're getting the lots for free from the city to test this out. But to actually establish the program itself, we're getting grant funding that we've cobbled together from a few different sources.
Now, this is a new idea for us in L.A. Other cities have tried similar things. What can Los Angeles learn from cities such as Philadelphia that have a long-standing Adopt-A-Lot program?
Yes, so I think this will be a good test for Los Angeles to really understand how we can put public assets in the hands of community members and sort of understand different limitations of that, but also the value of that. And community members will be part of this process and have more ownership of the neighborhoods that they live in.
Narya Kiani is with the Free Lots Angeles Collective. She's been telling us about a new pilot program to put LA's vacant lots to good use. Narya, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, now to a makeover of a different kind. Tustin resident Domenico Mastea has built a miniature Christmas village in his home every year since 1982. The project takes 6 weeks to put together, and people drive from far and wide to see the display, complete with snowmen, a flying angel, even a volcano. KPCC's Audrey Ngo has an inside look on what makes this Christmas wonderland a holiday tradition.
At first glance, Caper Tree Drive looks pretty sleepy this holiday season. But if you follow the string of parked cars near the street's cul-de-sac, there's a lot of buzz around one particular house.
In all of my years in California, I've never seen any kind of display like this.
That's Huntington Beach resident Mark Steele. He's standing in front of a 16 by 20-foot garage containing the neighborhood's Christmas village. It's a miniature holiday world with a carnival, a waterfall, a nativity scene, and much, much more. Think about looking down on hundreds of tiny plastic trees, ceramic houses, and tiny townsfolk set up in fake snow. All of this is built by 70-year-old Domenico Mastea. He's a retired machinist who's made the village his annual project for more than 3 decades. And proudly, he's never missed a year putting his village together. That's an extra large feat, as Mastea has survived stage 4 cancer in his nose and throat not one, but 2 times. Because of that, it's tough for him to talk for too long. But he has an explanation for how he's kept up his annual village assembly, despite his diagnoses.
I had to help from God.
He had help from God, he says. Mastea got the idea for the village after reminiscing about churches back in Calabria, the southern region of Italy where he's originally from. As a boy, he would help build a nativity scene in his church there, with some added flair.
In the church, we used to put the waterfall in the nativity. So that's where I got the idea the first time.
His display here in the States started comparatively small, with 2 sheets of plywood on his kitchen table. He built a nativity, some houses, and, of course, a waterfall, which has always been part of the scene. His son, Gianfranco Mastea, remembers coming home from school to that very first village.
Any type of box that he could find, he would convert it, cut windows in it, doors in it, put roofs on it, paint everything, and make them look like houses.
In the early 90s, the project became too big to stay inside. So Mastea moved it to his garage and invited family and close friends to marvel at his village. Since then, Mastea says thousands of people have come to see his work, including friends, random locals, and even people on tour buses who found out about his winter wonderland through word of mouth. Like many of Mastea's visitors, his neighbor, Jessica Crow, has made the village a family tradition for the past 5 years. What keeps her coming back isn't one particular thing. It's more of a feeling.
The magic, the joy that it brings to people. And I asked my daughter today, I'm like, why do you think that Mr. Maceda does this every year? Like, do you think it takes a lot of work or a little work? And she's like, a lot.
She's right. To get his wonderland up and running each year, Mastea works on it for more than a month leading up to December 1st. Some of the display's most notable features are an angel figurine suspended high on a string that keeps it flying from one end of the village to the other. Then there's the carnival, with ceramic patrons, a carousel, and a Ferris wheel with tiny white lights. But one of the standouts of the village every year is the paper volcano, a nod to Italy. Smoke rises from its top in a misty fog, while red lights bounce off a mylar sheet to simulate flowing lava. With everything that goes into this elaborate scene, people have suggested that Mastea charge admission to see his village. His son, Gianfranco, says that's not in the cards.
We'd rather help the community out and people that are less fortunate.
If visitors want to contribute to Mastea's work, they can bring canned food when they come see his display. After the holidays, he sends all donations to Second Harvest Food Bank in Irvine. Last year, Mastea counted 3,400 pounds of non-perishable donations. And as popularity for the Christmas Village grows, there's the looming question of how many more years Mastea will be able to carry on the tradition of building it. Luckily, he's not the only one who knows how to put it all together. Nearly a decade ago, during Mastea's last battle with cancer, he needed some assistance to get the village up and running. So Gianfranco stepped in and built the wintry scene under his father's supervision.
I just could not go a Christmas without it. I had to make sure that his dream was fulfilled that year.
And Gianfranco has his own family now, with two small children, a boy and a girl, who may become the next generation of village architects. For Take Two, I'm Audrey Ngo.
And if you'd like to visit the Christmas Village with a canned donation, the address is 2351 Caper Tree Drive in Tustin. The story will also be up with pictures and a video on our website, laist.com. All right, we're still waiting on the big announcement from United Teachers Los Angeles on a possible strike. And AirTalk will have more on that with Larry Mantle. He'll also be talking to new LAPD Chief Michael Moore. That's coming up next.